Welcome to my podcast, Chief Energy Officer, Time to Lead. My name is Boris Diekmann, and today I am joined by my friend Mika Jacobs. Mika is a friend, a writer, a storyteller, a coach, a sculptor, a leadership facilitator, a systemic coach and teacher. She's all of these roles and infinitely more than these labels are able to capture. And Mika is also a poet and has recently published a beautiful poetry book called Poet Assassin, The Poet and the Poem. And I'm delighted she's here today. So welcome, Mika, and thank you for making the time for human conscious leadership.
Thank you for having me. It's such a joy to see where this is going to lead us.
Absolutely, absolutely. I was delighted when we chatted and said, yeah, absolutely, let's do this. And maybe to kick us off, I feel as I was reflecting on this podcast and how it's evolving that with every conversation, I see this becoming, how should I say, a growing resource for leaders out there, for people committed to lead like a chief energy officer at work and in society, at home, a kind of go-to place, you know, for people who believe that a servant leader is a servant first, as Robert Greenleaf once put it. And in that spirit, I was intrigued and really touched by the last page of your book, the very last page. And in there you say, to read of man is to mourn mankind. To write of man is to fertilize humanity. I just love that. So I wanted to ask you, if this podcast was a poem, what kind of offer or invite would you like it to be? What would you like it to be in service of and, well, to use your words, fertilize? What questions would you like it to ask?
That's a beautiful opening question. And let me, in a way, connect the ending and the beginning of my book in that, because I also describe in the first part, in the prologue, the process of creation and how my poems come to me, which is an interesting exploration in itself. But at one point in time, and those are not my words, but I borrow them from other teachers. And it says, you know, after the whole creation process, and then the Great Spirit breathes life into it, and the word and the energy become one. And when you asked me up front what would be your intention, or if this podcast would be a poem, I really was connecting to the power of sometimes only one word or one sentence. The power of one word or one sentence to exactly have an acupuncture effect, you know, to land and almost as if your whole interior is reorienting around it, because it has landed at exactly the right place. So yeah, if this podcast would be a poem, then that is my wish, or my longing is that whoever is listening, just at one point in time, has that moment of reorientation in exactly the right amount. So that the word and the energy becomes one. And the interesting thing is, I never know what that's going to be, and which line it's going to be, and which word it's going to be, or which poem. But that would be my wish. That would be my longing. Also, because I have experienced that with a few very wise people myself, that, you know, they just say one thing and all of a sudden, yeah, the whole puzzle changes. So that would be my wish for this conversation.
I love that. I can so relate to it. I love the word of acupuncture, right? Of this one word. I remember how years ago I was in a retreat and someone in the morning, kind of to start the day, read a poem from David White, who you admire as well, and who's probably be also be one that you'd consider a teacher. And one of the very first times in my life, I experienced how all of a sudden I had tears in my eyes hearing a poem. I had never experienced that. And by the way, I didn't know it was David White. I wasn't even aware of the title of the poem. I just experienced like, oh my God, what's going on for me? I knew this from music, not from poetry yet. And only later, so I approached her and said, what is it you've been reading there? What's the title? And she said, Pilgrimage. And it, when you just said acupuncture, right? That was my acupuncture. I was like, oh, that's what's happening in my life right now. I'm knocking on doors. I'm searching. So what a lovely bridge into what we're exploring. And so if you build on from there, as we were focusing on, you're working a lot in the realm of leadership. And I mean this in the wider sense. It's not only leadership in the formal sense of or and only in organizations. I think leadership occurs in so many shapes and form across our entire society. The way you look at it, so how does poetry and leadership relate philosophically and practically? Are leaders poets and are poets leaders?
I love that as a thought. Maybe a few, and I, the interesting thing, what I notice now, I can always only speak from my own experience. And then, of course, that experience includes a lot of leaders, but there's no talking about without having experienced it myself. And in a way, I can take you back to the roots of my poetry for just a moment. Which is probably 12 years ago, where I learned the, I call it ceremony of writing haikus from a very tiny Zen master. His name was Aziz. And this was in Sweden. So he was completely out of place in a way. But in the evening, he would gather us around the fireplace and teach us the ceremony and the mastery of haiku. And what talking about an acupuncture needle, what struck me so much is that it just invites you, it forces you to go straight to the essence. Because you only have 17 syllables in Western language, obviously, to express the essence. And quite soon after, I started writing haikus about people, which is unusual for haikus. They're often about nature. They're often about seasons. But I started writing haikus for people that I just had met. And I would write a haiku for them the next day. And they were so struck by how I saw them, and I almost captured that in only a few words. So for me, that is what I more and more see in highly effective and impactful leaders, is that they capture the essence in a highly complex world. And even in my role, because I'm a coach and a facilitator, so I'm often a witness. In a way, I'm sitting at big tables, but as a witness and as a holder of, the container. So my interventions are not necessarily massive, but the few words that I say, if they are spot on and expressing the essence, then again you have that same effect, and all of a sudden the room has changed. So that's, at least in my relationship with leaders, the mastery that I practice through my poetry, and that all of a sudden also comes out in my work. It's even becoming less and less the use of my words, but very, very specific and very to the essence. And then the other aspect, and this is a big one, we might go into a deeper conversation about this. I'm really curious to hear about your experience. I was laughing when we started today, when we started our call, because I took my book again. I gave myself a break from my book for a few weeks only. because something really interesting happened the moment I published it and the moment I gave it to the world, is that it's a mutual relationship, you know, me and my book. It's a mutual relationship between me and my poems. And it was as if my book was just inviting me to live what I have written there. And not always in the easiest way. So it was quite confrontational. The moment you've put it out there, it felt like some dynamics came much more to my awareness and challenged me. And I talked about that with a very wise man. I think you probably know him, Marty. And he said, "That makes total sense to me because you wrote this book from your truest self and you have put that out there. And now your truest self is checking with you. Do you mean this? Are you serious? Are you serious about what you've written there?" And I see that in my work with leaders as well. In a way, they are taking, and it's not an official process anymore, but in a way, they are taking an oath in service of something, you know. And of course, we come from decades of being in service of growth and being in service of wealth. But more and more, I see, you know, they're taking an oath in service of communities. They're taking oath in service of sustainable growth, of nature, of the planet, of world peace. And it's not to be taken lightly. So that same process I see also coming back in my, and I'm very curious how you experience that because you work with leaders so closely and so intimately as well. I have the sense that they're also held accountable to their oath. They're held in alignment to their vows, to, you know, this larger system. And I think that's a hugely important movement. And it's not an easy one. It's almost as the moment you're out of alignment, also as a leader, you're corrected in quite a strong way. And that's some of the turbulence that I see. So there's a correction mechanism happening that is amplified at this moment. And that's beautiful work to explore that with leaders. But interestingly enough, I had to experience that myself again with publishing this book and, you know, sensing how my book was inviting me again, like, oh yeah, you talk about surrendering to life, you talk about being in alignment, you're talking about, you know, calling graceful warriors to step up for what they think is true and honest and in alignment, and you are very challenged. Do you mean that? You know, what's the proof? So that, you know, I see that in my work with leaders, and I have experienced it myself. And I took a 2 week break from that just to rest again and recenter myself and to be ready for that exploration.
Say a little bit more. I'll share my reflections a moment. You said there is, you know, it's a very strong correction then happening that you've observed. Say more about that. What do you see?
Again, from my own experience, I feel that, you know, the more I become sensitive to what is, and I'm using a terminology that I'm curious how that lands with you. So for me, I'm using the words I'm in alignment, right? Does this feel right? Or do I know that what I'm doing is actually, you know, it's not just the straight course? And I'm just becoming more sensitive and more aware. And with that comes a greater responsibility. And I notice now that the moment that I do deviate, for example, I feel something is wrong. I'm not addressing something directly with someone, but I'm taking a backstage route. And I know that that's not the right way to go. It's almost like if I do that, you know, the turbulence of that, making that clear to me becomes just much bigger. So, you know, the intensity of the response becomes much bigger. In other words, I don't get away with that anymore. You know, the more my awareness increases, the more I don't get away with some of
Wow.
those. So, yeah.
I can so relate to that. If I already noticed we need 2 hours, but so when I picked up your book and I noticed, oh, there is a whole chapter on haikus. I called, you know, a friend and colleague of mine and said, Oh my God, this is a sign. Yeah, because we've been using haikus in some of our retreats as well. And it relates in so many ways to what you've just said. So just for our readers, haiku is probably the shortest form of a poem in Japanese tradition. So hence why this invitation to condense and therefore also lose your intellect, because you can't say it. So, and often these haikus are born out of stillness. We're allowing for a lot of quietness and stillness, and just notice words that come up, and then you give it a form again. So you're dancing between the formless and the form. And sometimes I always have a doubt: is this really in service doing this? And every time we do it, I feel like people touch when we hear their voice. I'm often so, even if I'm recalling this right now, it moves me because I see the people in front of me. It moves me because they know that we know that they know that I know that we know that we're just touching something that is a genuine truth. Now, and with that comes what you're talking about, this, all right, what now? A beautiful creative tension between. Well, hold on. I also have some very real responsibilities in my board and with my colleagues, and in terms of finances. Well, how does that all fit in? So it creates turbulence. Like, whoa, there's, oh. And I think that turbulence, that confusion is helpful. If it was like, yeah, thank you, that's what I always said, where we're going nowhere. The other thing that I can so much relate to and that you ask about is if I think about the writing of my own book, but also my work with teams, I remember how a client, we helped her to become a facilitator in the work that we do. And one evening she approached me and said, Boris, you bring so much light, you're so lighthearted, you're so joyous. Are you always like that? And it wasn't entirely a question like, yeah, come on, get real here. And I said, let me think, give me a night to reflect upon that. It's a wonderful question. I think it points to the same thing that you notice. And then even the evening, I had at least one moment of clarity. And when we spoke over coffee next morning, I said, the answer is no. I am not always like that. I'm not. I get angry too, frustrated, irritated. The full range of feelings is available to me. We're drawing from the same human operating system, you and I. For me, doing this work and writing is a practice ground. It's my dojo. To stay in the Asian area. It's my dojo. And so, okay, here I can practice so that I can take maybe 1% of that and just become a little bit more conscious, just a little bit more. And the other thing that resonated in what you just said is this, you know, this stillness, well, is the notion of the world that we're living in, which becomes increasingly complex, chaotic. And so, how can leaders navigate in that? And when they're growing with increasing responsibility, which frankly, I haven't met anyone who found that overwhelming. They can maybe give the impression that it wasn't, but it is. And I think having stillness is more required so I can f actually feel that essence. You don't get there through reflection only. And maybe in that sense, what I'd love you to maybe continue exploring a little bit in this context is so what's the place then of, maybe that's a double question, right? What's the place of poetry in this world right now? So if I watch the news, there's a world that seems to be drowned at times in fear and separation rather than hope and connection. In scarcity more than in abundance, in experiencing wounding more than healing, numbing more than feeling. What's the place of poetry in all that?
I can answer that question from only in hindsight, in a way, because I never started with the question, "What's the place of poetry?" and then started writing poetry. So that's
Yeah,
also
of
what
course.
I mean, it's just, this is just a creative process that's unstoppable.
Yeah.
And from wherever the words come and the poems come, I mean, there's an infinite source of that as well. So even if there would not be a place for poetry in this world, I would still be writing it in a way. So that's an interest. So I just, in hindsight, of course, I can notice what the impact is. And it's interesting that the way we started our conversation, what the feedback I'm getting quite often in the last month, since end of October, since people can read them actually, is that they almost use my book as as a, like, I'm sitting with something and I just open your book on whatever page, and a poem is exactly the one that I needed. So that's also interesting. Of course, I didn't write it like that, but somehow this call and response is happening as well. So in a way, and then I think poetry can name things much stronger and gets away with that because, it's art and because, but I mean, there's this is if someone reads my book and afterwards says, "Oh, they were very lovely poems," then I would probably say read it again, because at least for me, they don't qualify as lovely poems. This is an invitation, right? This is a call. I mean, there's quite a lot of intensity in it, and there's quite a lot of invitation to stand for certain things, to name things, to see and not unsee, to not be blind, to use some of the power of our words. So, and in a form of poetry, you get away with, or you can do that without immediately polarizing, or without immediately, being on the barricades from a very angry place. It's interesting though. I mean, I don't know how you will do that, but the cover, the position that I am, some people read that as angry. It's not how I feel, but it's serious and it's determined, and I am occupying my place and I'm not going away, right? So that's what it means to me. But there's a certain level of fire in it. There's a certain level of, responsibility, or calling for responsibility and not shying away from that. And I think that's what poetry can do. That's sometimes what metaphors can do. I was working with an integration team this week, an acquisition situation, which is the previous book, but I asked both legacies to tell us the history and the founding story and use a metaphor to describe their ecosystem. And somehow, by using a metaphor, everything can be said in a non-judgmental way. So all of a sudden, it's not anymore about right or wrong. It's about, bringing it to the surface, bringing, the system to life, bringing the dynamics to life. And so metaphors, stories, poetry, I think can do that in a way that it's not immediately disruptive, aggressive. It's not immediately forcing people to choose sides. It's almost as if, yeah, you're capturing some essential truths that can be heard because it comes through the form of poetry. But again, that's based on the experience of me in interaction with people that have read them and that are, feeling into them and, that are expressing how they're landing. It was not necessarily the intention. For me, the intention is very much also like to make sense of the world, of life, of some of my own experiences. So it's, for me, it's indeed a contemplative practice that is quite essential to living, to living this life. And then the beauty is that that's the response. When you put that out there, there's somehow a response coming. And again, the more that that can spread, yeah, that then the fire is spreading. So
How beautiful. I mean, let me pick up on two things that you said. The one is, you can't predict. How could you? And it's never the intention to necessarily, I want that to happen. I just create it and I don't even know why. It's just there. I often felt like when I was writing, and it was when I was new to writing, like I'm writing down what I know, right? And there is some truth to it. And then sometimes when I've written something like, and I read it weeks later and restarted, like, oh, I like that. Hoo-hoo. It's like as if it was someone else writing. What you were pointing to is, I think there are as many versions of your book as there are readers. Every human will read it differently in a certain particular moment, if he or she read it at a different moment. So it's not only there are not as many versions of the book out there as there are readers. There are as many books out there as there are readers, multiplied by the moments they are in. So there is an
Wow.
infinity of books out there. It's actually an illusion that there is the one thing, just because it looks so similar. And I also relate so much to the notion of metaphor that you're using. I read in there's so many beautiful books about this notion of clean language, and these authors, they reminded me that they're kind of 80% or so. I mean, the number doesn't count, of our language is metaphorical. I mean, even the word metaphor is a metaphor. And I feel metaphors are such a powerful way to connect our mind and our heart and our soul. They tap into what is unfortunately unconscious to us. So they come on, let's dig a little bit out of that. And it's beautiful. So it's, I think also for leaders who want to use the attractiveness of a future state, call that inspiration, who work with inspiration, they need metaphors because that place doesn't exist yet. I mean, if it is existed, it would be easy. So metaphors are so powerful. And in that spirit, you mentioned that energy of determination in the book, the courage, the accountability. So say a little bit more about the metaphor of assassin. You called it poet assassin. What is it a metaphor for? If and I mean this in a very benign way, what needs to die?
In a way, I'll first share the references. So it's referring to a haiku and a poem in my book. Even though I knew it was a title of my book for many years, the poem, there's a poem I also read that as the first one when I launched it, is it's an experiment to infuse quite dominant and aggressive archetypes like assassin, like intruder, like smuggler, with totally different qualities, and to experiment with, and how can I hold those polarities, and how does the aggressive, the intrusive, the destructive archetype, if infused with grace, with poetry, with truth, how does completely shift the story and the essence. So that's that poem. I explored that there. And you could say, oh, that's a theoretical exploration, but it felt very much like me. Oh, it's that whole inner integration that I was looking for. And can I be both? What I'm realizing in the last years and years, and yet again in the last weeks, is that in a way I have been cast in the role of the calm one and the wise one and the one that does not get angry, and I'm breaking out of that as well. So I'm breaking out of that. So this, I mean, so it's highly personal at the same time. I could give you, oh, this is a universal exploration of how you infuse these two, or how you infuse these values and characteristics into these archetypes. And at the same time, I can also feel it's highly personal. So I think I'm going through that. Like, how have I been more invited into the, into suppressing some of the very human qualities as well. So yeah, so in that sense, it is all of a sudden coming out as a much more multifaceted person. And can I be? So that the poem also starts with "Can I be?" And when I worked with a wonderful theater director to just also prepare for the launch. And she, I mean, I thought we're just going to practice how to read these poems. Of course, that was not the case. The reality was that, oh my God, it came back right at me. Incredible, because writing is a whole different thing than speaking a poem. And she said, you know, it's about can I be? And because it starts with, can I be a twilight marauder stealing the truth between night and day? But she said, you know, can I be? There's something in that. So it's an exploration of, do I still belong if I'm in a way showing up as a multifaceted, fully human person and not just a mold of how to behave. So for sure that is that, and I'm really, really excited that I also had the courage to do it. You know, I could have taken any other title, but this was the one. And as I said before, that's also coming back to me. Like, are you serious about that? You know, what is it with that anger? Where is it? And it's difficult for me to find it. The other reference is it's a haiku, and it says, poet assassin, he can kill you with words or silence you to death. And there's something really essential for me in that as well. It's about the power of words, but it's also about the power of silence. And it is about looking away. And it is about yeah, do I stand for certain things, and can I, and do I express that, or do I choose to stay silent? So that's another exploration where also Poet Assassin is involved, but it's at least energetically still a whole other domain that I'm exploring, because I very often stay silent for the sake of harmony, and how real is that? And I'm experimenting with that. And oh my God, does that blow up in my face? And to work through that. Yeah, and because of course, you know, the temptation would be to go silent again. And that's of course not the invitation, but that exploration of words and silence is another deep one. So yeah, does that answer that question? There's probably much more to it.
I would be more than happy if it creates more questions than answers.
Yes, beautiful.
There
I would love that.
was
Yes.
who was it? There was some a scientist who said some questions are too good to be spoiled by an answer. And what you're pointing to, I can so relate to it. Think sometimes when I work with leaders, I ask them, so write down a few qualities that you want to be known for. That's an easy task. You can almost predict it or say that pick from this list. And then you ask, what are a couple of qualities you don't want to be known for at all? Like, no way. And think, well, let's talk about exactly that. So if you throw that away, then you throw away a huge part of life. I think the notion of dualism means that, we come into this world and then we discover things. And at some stage we discover, oh, that gives me love and that protects me and that doesn't. So we do a little bit more of that and a little bit more and a little bit more. And over time, we're dividing the world into one half and another half. Dualism created. And maybe the second half is arises, what's the half that I'm constantly throwing away because I've labeled it as something wrong? Now, I'm not inviting people to go around and become assassin. That's not what you're pointing to. It's a
No,
metaphor. Like, if there was any quality and any energy, let's explore what is the thing that you're not looking at because it creates a big, nice picture of you. And what you're pointing to is that there is some profession, including our own, that is highly susceptible to not look around shadows. So priests, teachers, coaches, leaders are highly endangered to either put themselves into this or for others to put it upon them. Like Boris, you're supposed to be the quiet guy. You're supposed to be the kind. You're so this and you're so that. And it's actually easy to say, yeah, I am all that. Thank you very much for giving me another reason not to look into my own shadows. So thank you for bringing that question in here.
One of the most beautiful responses and that I got was from a client. This is a leader that I'm working with for 6 years or so already. I mean, with different teams, and she moved company, and now I work with her team in that other company. And she wrote to me. She said, "As I'm reading your book, I have the sense that I've not been looking at you all these years." And I was really moved by it because first of all, she was willing to look now, but also because I just realized that I did not show up as my fullest. Because indeed we are in a way as coaches, I mean, we're the wiser, we are the one that, has the big container. I mean, and I had not allowed her, again, who I had really a close relationship with, I had in a way also not allowed her to see me. So I found that a really beautiful, it really moved me, where in a way it sounded from her side a bit apologetic, as if she had done something wrong by not, by not looking well enough. But I really could immediately sense that I had a big part in that. And that's quite beautiful with the more recent engagements, like one of my recent leaders, and I totally love her. She just showed her book to her friends and she said, "That's my coach." And everyone said to her, "That makes sense." So, I mean, just like it has evolved. And that's also beautiful to explore that, I am showing more of me. I'm actually not afraid to, gift the book to the leaders that I work with, even though it's a, again, they see another side of me. They see quite a deep exploration of me if they dig into it, but I'm not shy about that. Initially, I thought it was a bit maybe, yes, I'm publishing it, but at one point in time, I had the shattering insight that it's so interconnected to everything that I do, to my work with leadership, to my own journey, to, the fields of work and wisdom that I've been studying and trying to bring into companies and teams and leaders. And ever since then, it's just a part of me. It's not a separate thing anymore.
Just one way that it meant that you manifest, right? It's
Exactly.
just one of the many ways.
Exactly. And even, I worked with a lady to organize the event, and there were people like that. They now think, now no, I want to do more of that. I want to be a full-time poet. I was like, no, it's not disconnected from what I do. It's an expression. It's a manifestation, as you say. It's one of the ways it flows, and it flows beyond my own contemplative exploration. But in no way has this changed my identity into, something like, it's not that I was a writer hoping to one day be a full-time writer, not at all.
I can fully
Yeah.
see that.
Yeah,
And
I'm looking at your face and I'm thinking about Chief Energy Officer, and I guess it's the same, like
People ask us, so when does your next book come out? I said,
yeah.
I'm sorry, that one, I don't know. It wasn't on my checklist. And I absolutely wanted to ask you about this. For those who will ever read your book, they will see that there's not only poetry in there, there are also pictures of your sculptures in there, made of clay, I think. Say a little bit more about that. How did they find their way into this little collection of carton and paper?
Yeah, pure magic. Because those are not my sculptures. I'm also a sculptor, but in stone. And that's a very different art form. The sculptor that made these clay sculptures said, you know, stone is taking things away so that the sculpture appears, and clay is you're building the sculpture, so it's a different movement. So I'm also a sculptor, but in stone. And somewhere in this creative process, after I had a quite turbulent year, and I worked through a lot of things, and all of a sudden in June I started to feel the space. And then this creative urge appeared, and as of then, magic happened. So I truly feel that the sculptures came to me. So I reached out to Truus, who made the sculptures, still with an idea like, I know you're a sculptor. I was wondering whether you do drawings of before you make a sculpture, but if not, do you know someone who could maybe make illustrations for my book? But I love your sculpture. So it was a, you know, it was a, like asking you, but I don't know whether you would even think about that. And I mean, she must have replied within the next hour with, the strongest yes. And she offered me, she said, you know, what if I would make clay sketches and those would be, as photos in your book? And I was still in the illusion that a clay sketch is a drawing. That you first make a drawing and then you make a clay sculpture, but that's not it. A clay sketch is right away in clay. So it's truly what comes through your hands. It's nothing that you think about and you completely think through. It's really what comes through your hands. So what she did is she read my poems. She really met me, we didn't talk much, but she read my poems and we connected there. And then I just feel she has been bringing my words and my whole inner world in a 3D form. They are incredible. I actually was with her today, and it's a series of nine. And I have felt so seen and so seen in just that whole process, because literally I see my whole inner world in those sculptures without any instructions. And of course it was a whole journey for her as well, because the sculptures probably have different meaning for her, but for me they were a super accurate expression of what I wanted to say about the vibration of my words. So yes, so that was the magic of the sculptures. And the interesting thing is, I wrote to her, I said, I want to buy these nine sculptures, like I want. And then she said, well, I can't sell them to you because they won't last. Because clay is perishable. And of course you can, do clay and then bake it and then make it a bronze sculpture, but not with these, because they're really sketches. In a way, they're unfinished sculptures. So they're not, if you would bake it, you ha would have to make it perfect and have all the air out. And that's not going to work with those. So the sculptures are still there, but indeed some, has become smaller. One has an arm broken off already. And I thought how beautiful and how illustrative for the whole exploration of my book. At least part of the exploration is, what is this life about? What is this relatively short journey that we're on, that is both highly personal and universal? And then to have that translated into perishable clay, it's in a way just would put water over it and they're gone. And it, in a way, that's also a metaphor for how short our life is, and my exploration of the significance of it. So yeah, for me, it was a beautiful alchemy, to bring those two together. And yeah, I cannot be more grateful for that co-creation.
A wonderful story, and yet another beautiful, beautiful metaphor in so many infinite ways. I was in a conversation with someone who said, "Yeah, well, looks like now as leaders we need to be more vulnerable." I said, "I'm not sure that's the idea. I think it's just remembering that you're freaking born vulnerable. You always were. I don't know when the illusion started that you weren't. We just remember it. And clay can be a metaphor for that. Well, you have to harden it. for it to maybe survive a few years longer.
A few years longer, indeed.
That's it, right? And it's also if you form it with your hands, well, the clay always remains the same. So maybe you as a leader, you're being formed, sure, through things that happen through outer hands and your own hands. And eventually, maybe you see you're in touch with the clay, not the outer form. And maybe it's a segue to, I wanted to ask you if you could share a little bit more about yourself in the sense that the way you look at the world right now, be that with your hat of artist or sculptor or coach, whatever hat you put on, right? You probably haven't looked at the world the way you see it now. It will change if we talk in 10 years' time, and I hope we will. And it will have been different if we had spoken 10 years ago. So I wanted to, and you've mentioned so many beautiful people already. And it's probably a long list of people who you consider as teachers, as companions in your life. So what were, for you, a few, shall we say, pivotal moments, people or events that somehow informed or shaped the way you look at life and maybe for our listeners at leadership today. And maybe also your role as coach. What were a few people or moments that come to mind and say, well, they stand out for me somehow?
Wow, and the moment you're asking that question, someone really unexpected comes up. So, and I will name him in a moment. I'm going to start with your question, how do you look at the world right now? And it's a very interesting combination of a bleeding heart, for what I see. And again, that's also very much an exploration in Poet Assassin, a complete surrender to the much larger forces that, that lead to the symptoms that we see. So it's a very sometimes challenging combination. So there's this surrender, almost my forehead on the floor and surrendering to a larger movement of life that I'm a part of, and at the same time not becoming numb to some of the things we see. And interestingly enough, the moment you asked me about the companions, of course I could name the ones that are there now, and they matter. I feel very blessed with many companions, but the first one that came to my mind is the naturopath that, in a way, we grew up with. So I think when I was 9 and my brother was 6 and my sister was 11, my mom was in a very vulnerable place for a long time, and she took my brother for a specific question to this doctor who had a very holistic view. And after I think their initial conversation, he said maybe the mother needs this more than the son, which of course created a whole flood of tears and realization that that was very true. But ever since then, we were, as children, we were taken to him probably every 2 to 3 months, which I'll be honest, I hated as a child. I had no idea what to do with it. I mean, I was 10, 11, 12, and I was supposed to talk about myself to this stranger who was Dutch, by the way, so, had a slightly different accent. So I also did not understand him completely at times, so which was very uncomfortable. And at the same time, I can now realize that in a way, I'm 51 now. Ever since I was 10, I did have a very strong imprint of exploring what's happening inside of me, exploring what that means, exploring what I can learn from that, exploring dynamics. And I mean, it's just a wealth of inner self-reflection, but also seeing almost the whole constellation out there. So I had not expected that he would come up. He has passed away few years ago. But all of a sudden, the moment you asked, I was like, yes, that's a very early imprint of how I live my life, which is very much a never-ending curiosity about why things are the way they are. A never-ending commitment to see my part and to, yeah, to see the whole constellation dynamic. So yeah, in a way, it's very interesting that he came up. So yeah, in loving memory, but also very uncomfortable memory of Hans van den Braak, was his name, as the earliest imprint. And then ever since then, I think, you know, yes, influential people have come on my path. I will name one, and I think you know her as well, that for me is so instrumental in this moment. It's our energy teacher. Her name is Linda Cesera, from Berkeley, California. But in the most embodied way, she truly templates to how to sort things, and you know, with a lot of care, but with no nonsense. She's just a master in sorting and in measuring, and in a way also bringing me back to my body. And that's something that is still relatively new in my exploration, that, you know, the body has something to do with it. Like, very, for a very long time, you know, my tendency was to try to understand it with my head and to not feel the body that much, and to certainly not think that anything was happening in terms of, you know, trauma, contraction, etc. And so for me, I mean, yeah, the capacity of the body to store trauma, but also the capacity of the body to be an instrument and a massive holding container, is something that I'm learning from her. So yeah, I would name her as a true source of wisdom, a beacon of light. Yeah, for a few years now.
Oh, beautiful. Let's just take a little bow to all those teachers around us. Some don't carry the name, and we
True.
realize it later.
Indeed.
And if I'm thinking about our listeners and people who are in leadership roles right now, I sometimes sense that when we're talking about being embodied or in our body, it sounds like a very abstract thought. It's like, what the
Yes.
heck are they talking about? I thought my body was there to carry my brain around it, and that has served me well. Well,
And it's also coaching slang, right? Like embodied, somatic, and you're like, what?
What do you want from me? I feed it well. I'm doing sports with it, right? But it doesn't help me, you know, to kind of plan my next year's EBITDA. If you had one invitation, right, just one practice or one thing to begin noticing for leaders out there to just begin noticing or simply continue or practice. How should I say, using my body, using the wisdom of my body in day-to-day business, right? What would you, if it was a leader asking you this, right? And not the facilitator of this podcast, what would you offer to them?
And I love the challenge. You know, last year I spent quite some time training other facilitators, which was beautiful. It was such a joy. And, you know, facilitator slang was, you know, what I used quite a lot, because we get used to words like that all the time. And after a while, you're just living on a different planet. You know, where happy. You know, happy exploration, but I have no idea what you're talking about, and it certainly does not relate to me. So, point taken and challenge taken, big time. I think what I use lately and what really resonates is the notion of survival state and healthy state. So, you know, the nervous system. I mean, there's in the meantime so much research on that, so that sometimes I use that. But the fact that your nervous system, can be in flow state, but can also be in a truly survival state. And in that sense, I work with quite a lot of leaders, making them understand that their whole team is in a constant survival state. And that there's, in the meantime, so much research that in a survival state, you're not making the right decisions. You're very focused. I mean, your whole body is designed to do that. And for me, that has proven to be an entry into this, because I fully with you, by the way. Again, for me, this is a relatively recent exploration. This whole notion that your body is anything to do with that. So I still can very much relate to the, how foreign it sounds and how foreign it feels. But the nervous system and the survival state, that speaks to them. The other thing, again, another source of recent discovered source of wisdom. I had a keynote. I listened to a keynote of Owen Eastwood, who's a very high performance coach in sports, and he's a New Zealander, and he has a whole body of work around belonging. But the work that they're doing with these, high performance, right? Because this is the highest competition in sports, and the realization how their parameters lead to their performance, that's also an entry. Because again, we are all interested, at least in the corporate world, we're interested in performance. And he has this amazing body of work in how the sense of belonging impacts the performance. And again, also that. So I love people that also can bridge that, because if we become too out there, being on an island with all our beautiful personal exploration, the disconnect becomes even bigger. So those are two entries that, I really feel land in executives, land in leaders, make total sense as well. So yeah, that's my recent experience, knowing that there's so much more out there, and at the same time, indeed there is a next quarter to perform. There is real business challenges on the table. It's interesting, even in my work, I notice myself evolving to a better balance between the two. So yes, some deep exploration, but for the sake of what? For the sake of what? So not because now we're all digging into our deepest personal stories in the context of the corporation, which doesn't feel safe for everyone. No, how can we, how can we expand our capacity to lead ourselves and our teams in order to really achieve not only the objectives, by the way, but also what we discussed earlier, the larger invitation to our big industries to look beyond growth and profit. So for me, it's all connected. And the more you connect the dots, I think the more it lands, and there's a, there's a collective acceleration of it.
Oh, thank you for expressing that. I can absolutely relate to every word. And what you just pointed to, the mere reflection upon or noticing that that you and I and everybody listening and all the others exist in different states, and at least two, and then everything in between. I call it open heart and closed heart, whatever metaphor you want to use. And these in return are not good and bad. Nature didn't do us the favors. So I gave you some good things and I said, you have all of it. But sometimes I think it's a good idea to discover how does this operating system work rather than I'll just click, I'm just hammering on it. I said, oh, you click there, you have a little bit less perspective. That's good to know. I think the strange thing is that we often, I think very often, and this sounds a little bit naive, but often problems are situations seen from a closed state of heart, state of mind, or when I'm in a defensive, survival mode, because there's less to be seen from there. And even if I can just be aware, I'm in this state right now. Okay, good. Well, now I know. That is a lot. That is a lot.
Yeah, for me, a big learning from the last 2 years was that even the narrative in your head, is influenced by the state of your nervous system. So when you go into that survival state and in a, for example, in a complete shutdown, then the narrative becomes much more dramatic as well. It becomes like, there's no other solution. We will never get out of this. It's hopeless. It's black and white. There. So it's, for me, that was a really big realization because I can recognize the narrative now. When I'm in a narrative of this is never going to be solved, now the only option is to break this apart, or I'm like, oh, interesting narrative, probably related to the state of my nervous system. And even that knowing gives it a bit more space, and it evolves over time, and then you work through it. And that's on an individual level. And both you and I work with the nervous system of a team. I mean, the nervous system of a team can be in a complete survival state. And then there's nobody sees any way out of it anymore, or it becomes very polarized, or it hardens. So that expands to teams, to organizations, to what we see in the world
To societies, yeah,
and to
absolutely.
society.
And I love your thinking about this in the sense that if we can look at it that way, all the phenomena we see, both extremism, on the rise, wars, etc. If you can also, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but if you put on the lens of what you're seeing is what nervous systems do, who are in a chronic survival state. And who don't even know that because that's become normal. They've grown up that way. So they people there, that's how reality feels. That's actually true. And from that state, life looks different. It actually is dangerous. And even if I then come for somebody who is fearful, I believe somebody who is loving is still very dangerous. Because from a fearful state, well, everything is dangerous. And but if we can see that, then maybe some of our answers might become different ones. Because then it becomes about how can we help one individual at a time, one team at a time, for all these nervous systems to come a little bit healthier so that we look differently, can meet differently. These are conversations we have at home with our children every day. When 6-year-old asks, "So, Daddy, why are they killing each other? I don't understand that." So thank you for bringing this in. And as you said, it's on an individual, team, societal level. Maybe as a way to just looking at time, to kind of to round it up or
Close.
so,
Yeah.
if you had a magic wand. Because like poetry is also magic in so many ways, right? And if you had a magic wand, and with that you could have one wish coming true that would make our organizations and the teams that you spoke about just a little bit, well, better led or healthier, whatever you wish for. What would you do with that magic wand? What would you wish for?
It's a very, very interesting, difficult question. The first thing that came to my mind when you started asking the question is, and this is really magical. I was like, I would love to move to Rivendell. I don't know if you know Rivendell. It's the elves' world in Middle Earth in Lord of the Rings.
Granted.
Somehow there, I it, and it only recently happened when I was regulating myself after a shock to my nervous system, and I was regulating myself, and all of a sudden I had this image of Rivendell coming up, a longing for Rivendell, a longing for a different world. But of course, that I mean that that almost, I mean let's still hold that there. What would I do with my magical wand? Why it's in a way, I would say, to somehow lift our awareness of some of these things that we have explored. And at the same time, I learned from one of my other teachers that you also know, Thomas Hubel, that the world might not be ready to completely lift the veil on some things. So maybe in the right amount, in the right amount that is needed. Yeah, I think that would still be my. One of the things Linda taught us in Energy Mastery, for example, when we start a workshop or a facilitation, like make ev may everyone receive what they need in the amount that they need it from whom they need it from. So, in the amount that they need it in from whom they need it from, as if, it's also calibrating what is possible. And yeah,
I
so
hear you.
that may be where it's ripe, may it evolve, may it accelerate. And with those pockets, may other things become ripe. So and maybe Rivendell is the long term the long term vision of that.
Yeah, we always need to shoot higher. It's
Exactly.
thank you. I can relate to that. And what a wonderful, what a wonderful intention to set out even before you go into a board meeting, right? And
Exactly.
for your and for yourself. It doesn't only happen in huge retreats, where we do learning. And I have a wish.
Magic wand.
My wish is, you said before that speaking is very different from writing, and I'd love you to speak one of your poems, if you may, to kind of round this out, and so that the voice of your poems can be heard through your voice. I'm not sure if anyone comes to mind that you feel like, it wasn't my intention to put you on the spot here.
Well, you suggested that earlier, but I also said I cannot decide on one beforehand because I don't know where a conversation is going. But I think based on what we just said, I'll choose Kingdom. I also have a poem with some of those dimensions, which is called Eden, but there's still, Eden is still me working through some of the anger, and Kingdom is maybe already, a vision in that. And I'm telling you that up front because otherwise you might think, oh, that's weird, but I'm playing with the masculine and the feminine in one sentence here, so I switch genders in the same sentence, so just so you know, otherwise you might think like that's strange.
My friend, my suspicion is the world needs a lot of that right now.
Yeah,
So,
exactly. So I'll
thank
choose
you.
I'll choose Kingdom. All is well in the kingdom. When the curtain falls, we will remember that all is well in the kingdom and always has been. All is well in the kingdom when the king is devoted to the nation, attends to her land and her clan. There is no sign of siege. When the king takes his rightful place in the lineage that brought her forth, he is no more, no less than the foremothers that handed her the keys. When the king beseeches the guardians of her lands to linger at the turning of the wheel of time. When the queen mother matures in her fatherhood of all sentient beings. All is well in the kingdom when the queen conquers the hearts of all who populate his shores with kindness of the purest form. When her crown is the portal to his essence. All is well in the kingdom when the sovereign, the monarch, the crowned head surrenders to the almighty source, discerns the whispers of the future, chants the hymns of all the way back until since always. Call for leadership.
Aho.
Aho.
My friend, let's not add anything to that. It's been a gift, just a pure gift and a joy. You brought tears to my eyes doing this together. I can feel you. I can feel what you're touching. You're touching me. Thank you for this hour. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me in this meeting of hearts and spirits.